From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The book of Revelation, the last book in the New Testament, barely made it into the Bible. With all its references to erupting volcanoes and monsters and horrors, it's always been controversial, but it's also been really popular over time. You'll find the strange images from the book in art and literature, and they're deeply embedded in the way many Christians envision their place in the world as a cosmic struggle between good and evil. The scholar Elaine Pagels says these revelations survived because their author was asking the big questions, like, when will justice be done? The book offers a language or a framework for people to attach their own conflicts and fears and hopes. Today in the program, Pagels will join us to walk us through the visions, prophecies, and politics of the book of Revelation after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The British playwright George Bernard Shaw once called the book of Revelation a curious record of the visions of a drug addict. It's the last book in the New Testament, and with all its trippy images of dragons and golden cups and winged soldiers, it would be easy to dismiss. But the fact is, the book of Revelation has played a powerful role in the way Christianity evolved and the way modern Christians see their place in the world as a cosmic struggle between good and evil. The scholar Elaine Pagels says these revelations have survived because they speak less to our head than our heart. They speak about what we fear, but also what we hope. Pagels has been studying the book of Revelation for years now, and she's recently published a book about what she's learned. It's called Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. Today in the program, she's joining us to talk about it. Elaine Pagels is a professor of religion at Princeton University, and she's the author of many books on Christianity and Gnosticism, including The Origin of Satan and the Gnostic Gospels. She's joining us today from the studios on the campus of Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey. Professor Pagels, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we're going to come back around to this in the end and talk in more detail about this. But one thing I wanted to know, first of all, was how your interest in the book of Revelation was affected by your study of the Gnostic Gospels and other books that weren't included in the Christian canon, because it seems like the book of Revelation created a kind of, I don't know, we'll talk about this as we go, but a kind of dogmatic brand of Christianity. And you've written about how these lost books are much more kind of expansive and compassionate. The book of Revelation, though, of course, is the one that made it in the Bible. So the image of, you know, approaching the world of divine judgment is the one that stuck. So how are you thinking Yes. about that and this?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, you know, I started out being interested in the history of Christianity and wanted to find out as much as I could about how this movement started, how you get from Jesus of Nazareth, you know, crucified as a traitor against Rome, as the Romans saw him, to the extraordinary profusion of kinds of Christianity you find all over the world today. So it's only when I went to graduate school that I had the surprise of discovering that there were other gospels we hadn't heard of or that weren't part of the New Testament. Right. And so that became a very important part of the story, because now we know that there was a lot about Christianity that we never knew before. Many of these other books, secret gospels and other revelation texts, just give quite a different context to, you know, the Bible and the collection of books that we find there. So I suddenly realized, besides other Gospels, there were also lots of other Revelation texts. Mm. But they're not like the one in the New Testament.
Yeah. You've said you chose to explore the book of Revelation because, I think you put it this way, it's the toughest case for this question that you've been asking yourself about religion for years, and that is, why do people still engage with these stories? Why has it persisted? What do you mean that the book of Revelation is one of the toughest cases for all of this?
Well, that's a good question. But, you know, I grew up in a family that was Protestant, Christian, but my father had given it up for Darwin and became a biologist, thought that the Bible was just for people who, you know, who liked sort of old folk tales.
Yeah.
So I was told that, you know, as soon as people were educated enough in science, they wouldn't be interested in religion anymore, certainly not engaged in it. But here we are in the 21st century, and religion has not vanished at all. In fact, it's thriving and you know, passionately involved with many groups that we see all over the world. Mm. So I began to realize that it's not so much about conceptual beliefs like, do you believe in God or something, something like that. But religion has a great deal to do with our emotional lives and what we're afraid of, what we hope for, how we imagine our place in the world. The book of Revelation really speaks to emotion. It doesn't speak conceptually at all.
Let's put the book of Revelation in context to some of the other books in the New Testament. I guess its defining characteristic is that it's really strange. I mean, there are no stories really in here, no moral teachings, no parables, no appeal to love your neighbor necessarily. It's very odd.
Well, it is. If you look at the Gospels, you know, they're all narratives about the life, the teachings, the activities, the death, the resurrection of Jesus, you know, and his stories, his parables, his, as you say, the teachings about love one another and so forth. But here you have a book that is nothing but, you could say, dreams and nightmares, because it's all visions. And some of them are nightmarish and some of them are quite glorious. But they don't quite hang together as a story. It's a picture that John draws of a battle between the forces of good and the forces of evil. Mm. And he sees it playing out in the world. And that's the basic drama. You know, the forces of evil have taken over the world. God will not tolerate this forever, but will, you know, send his spirit down and send the Messiah, Jesus, down to fight the evil powers in the world and then destroy them and judge the world and start over with a whole new universe.
Explain who wrote it. This was John of Patmos. He was a Jewish follower of Jesus of Nazareth, sometimes regarded as a prophet, a second-generation follower, I guess we should point out.
Yes. I mean, as you know, most Christians are taught that the book of Revelation is written by the disciple of Jesus, whose name is John. Yeah. But the author doesn't say that. He talks about the 12 disciples, but he never says he's one of them. He's probably a different John. We call him John of Patmos because he says he wrote on this island. And I think he was writing maybe 60 years after the death of Jesus, trying to understand why when Jesus said the kingdom of God was coming soon, it hadn't come yet.
Yeah.
And in fact, his own people, the Jewish people, had been attacked and destroyed by the Romans in an enormous war that happened 30 years after the death of Jesus. And he was trying to understand how God could allow such terrible things to happen on earth.
So that first generation of followers of Jesus, they thought Jesus was going to lead them to, you know, to victory over the Romans. And then when he's killed, it left a lot of these people disoriented, disillusioned, and a lot of people left the movement, I guess, at that time.
Well, it could be. I mean, maybe I think followers of Paul probably didn't think that way so much, although Paul also said that, you know, Jesus would come back very soon.
Yeah.
And he had said he would come back during the lifetime of his apostles. That's in the Gospels of Mark and the Gospels of Luke. But that didn't happen. So some people were saying, well, the prophecy failed. I mean, he was a failed prophet. And John said he came to the conviction that the prophecy hadn't failed, it just delayed a bit, and that Jesus was coming, and Jesus had spoken to him personally and presented visions and told his followers, hold on, the end is coming. Yeah. If you endure till the end, you'll be saved. And God is about to come and transform the world.
So this John belongs to I guess, a more kind of radical sect. And do we know what would he have made of Paul and the way Paul was preaching of the gospel? Because you talk about how there were a lot of disputes among Jesus's followers and apostles at that particular time.
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, whether we should call it a sect or not, I don't know.
Yeah.
As you said, John was a Jew. But, of course, so was Jesus, so was Peter, so was Paul, James, and, you know, probably all the original disciples. So I guess the question we need to say is, well, whenever did this become a Christian movement? I mean, how did we get from Judaism to Christianity? And many Christians think it started with Jesus. Certainly his life and death and his teachings were a pivotal moment. But he himself didn't exactly create a new movement. So some people think Paul was somebody who catalyzed a very different kind of teaching. But John is somebody who apparently saw Jesus in a way that traditionally minded Jews would have seen him, as Israel's Messiah, the one who was coming to liberate Israel and destroy the forces of evil, by which they meant the Roman Empire that was then occupying Israel. Because this book is not just about, you know, a spiritual battle. It's about how Israel was destroyed by the Romans and how Jews could live in that empire. And I think really we don't understand it very well till we see that this book is written by somebody who had probably lived through this terrible Jewish war against Rome, revolution against Rome, which failed. And it's kind of a book that comes out of war. So he writes it about the forces of good against the forces of evil, which basically meant Israel against Rome.
Yeah. And you mentioned that John would have seen the constant reminders of Roman rule, the monuments, statues, temples to the gods everywhere.
Well, the Romans had marched into Jerusalem with 60,000 troops and totally destroyed the center of Jerusalem. I mean, if you go today to Jerusalem, you can see these massive stones that the Roman soldiers threw down from the temple, destroyed the whole center of the city. It's never been rebuilt. It's just basically a pile of rubble to this day. So John would have been horrified by that. I mean, it's like seeing, you know, the World Trade Towers in New York suddenly reduced to rubble. It's a tremendous shock to the whole nation.
You see, John is troubled, of course, by Roman rule, but he's also, you say in the book, disturbed by the fact that the followers of Christ aren't fighting against Rome, that they're trying to coexist, some of them anyway, trying to find these compromises with Roman rule. So it wasn't just a fight against, you know, evil, but the accomplices of evil.
Well, yes, because the movement, as you know, I mean, some of the followers of Jesus were Jews, probably most in the beginning. But then apparently there were people listening to the message that Paul preached, which was, he said, for Gentiles, for non-Jews. They were from Syria and Africa, Egypt, Spain, from all over the world. And many of them became followers of Jesus. But they weren't Jewish. They didn't sort of keep kosher food. They didn't practice kosher customs. And so they were kind of unfamiliar with Judaism as John was deeply immersed in it. And that created a kind of tension between Jewish followers of Jesus in some cases and non-Jewish followers of Jesus who sort of saw differently what this Jesus movement was about.
So I'm trying to get this image of John of Patmos. He's on this island, kind of obscure place, and you write about him kind of brooding about this war. And you say that I guess we can kind of imagine him pacing, you know, lying awake at night thinking about this really brutal slaughter of his people. And there's this powerful reference in the book, I think it's in chapter 6, where it says, God's people cried with a loud voice saying, how long, O Lord, do you not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on this earth? So John's saying, when are you going to come and do this? When are you going to avenge this horrible slaughter, I guess?
Yes. Actually, what happens in that passage, as you know, is that John says he was taken up and was allowed to glimpse heaven.
Yeah.
And under the throne of God, he saw the souls of people who had been slaughtered, probably his own people.
Right.
And they were crying out, how long before you judge and avenge our blood on the people of the earth? This cry is actually echoing a cry you find in the prophet Isaiah, chapter 26 and 27. So John is consciously drawing on the sort of legacy of the great prophets of Israel, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel, who also were intensely concerned about God's people, Israel, and how the foreign nations could conquer it, lay it waste, take its people into exile, kill them, and so forth. And so John is in that tradition of Israel's prophets.
So the book comes to John. He describes it as a kind of ecstatic trance, I guess.
Yes.
You know, what interests me about that is there's some speculation about how we could understand that. I mean, it could be just a spiritual vision, of course, but, you know, there's some sense that it could have come from he was fasting. And it's often described in a kind of flip way, as I mentioned the George Bernard Shaw, you know,
yes,
idea that it was a drug trip. But it does make me wonder, does anyone actually make the case that it was something hallucinogenic or something? Does that make sense?
Well, a lot of people actually have suggested that.
Yeah.
And we don't know. I mean, but I don't see any evidence of that. One does find it in – there's another book written exactly the same time. It's called The Revelation of Ezra by another Jewish prophet. And Ezra was also weeping over the destruction of his people in right. that war, writing just at the same time John was writing, about 20 years after the war. And in the book of Ezra – I mean, Ezra happened to be a Jewish prophet but not a follower of Jesus – he said he also had visions and learned from these visions that there would be a judgment day, the Messiah would come, though he didn't think the Messiah was Jesus. Ezra actually says he was instructed to eat certain plants and fast and go out in the field. Now, we don't know what he ate, but there's no evidence that John did. I think in the absence of any other evidence, it's at least obvious that his visions – which actually many people do have spontaneously, are shaped by his reading of the classical prophets. Mm. But he does feel that Jesus appeared to him and gave him urgent messages.
Jesus appears to him kind of in the form of the prophet Daniel, I guess.
Yes, in a form that he's thought Daniel saw as a kind of angelic, powerful, sort of extraordinary figure with sort of brilliant, shining faces and so forth. It's quite a stunning vision.
Yeah. And the essence of the vision, I want to work through some of the details as we go, but basically it's God is going to make this great cosmic war on the evil powers that had taken over the world, and the evildoers will be thrown into this lake of eternal fire. And I'm wondering, this idea of this harsh divine judgment is, you know, pretty familiar today for a lot of Christians. How new was the idea, though, that kind of judgment for the time?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, you don't find it much in the Hebrew Bible, really. Mm. But you do find it in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in Israel in about 1945, and they were written by a radical sect of Jews who felt that many of their people were accommodating to the Romans and even collaborating with the Romans, and that they were betraying their own people. So these people went out in the desert and created a kind of community, basically a community of men banded together to sort of be an outpost of God's people, you know, who were really waiting. And they talked about cosmic war. They wrote a scroll, which is called the Scroll of the War of the Sons of Light Against the Sons of Darkness. And they say, well, now it's a fight between God's people and Satan's people. Mm. And many Jews even have been taken over by Satan, as well as, of course, the Romans. And we are going to fight with the angels when that final day comes. And we're going to win the battle, and God is going to transform the world. And this teaching was in place before Jesus of Nazareth preached, before John the Baptist preached. Mm. And many scholars think that John the Baptist and possibly Jesus had heard about this sort of apocalyptic preaching about a coming day of judgment, a coming battle of the forces of good against evil. This is an idea you do find intensely preached about 100 years before the time of Jesus, and then by Jesus, by John the Baptist, and by many of his followers.
So Jesus does make reference to a cosmic war.
Well, you know, the Gospel of Mark says when he was baptized, the Spirit came upon him and drove him into the wilderness, as chapter 1, into fight with the Satan.
Right.
And then he came back. And he said, the kingdom of God is coming soon. Repent and believe in the good news. And at the end of the Gospel of Mark, chapter 13, he talks about there's going to be war, there's going to be rumors of war, there's going to be catastrophe. Enemy armies are going to surround Jerusalem, and terrible, terrible things will happen. But then the end will come. The Son of Man will appear in the clouds, and God will reign. Mm. So Jesus preached, apparently, that kind of message.
So John's vision then would not have been that unprecedented to what
Jesus
was saying.
it's not unprecedented among Jews who felt they were really devout. And yeah. probably it was some Jews who were very devout who started the revolution against Rome 30 years later. I mean, Jesus was executed, as you know, by the Romans on charges of saying that he was a king. They thought he was trying to start a revolution and throw out the Romans. Now, he probably wasn't, but that's what they thought because there were many people saying that kind of thing. And 30 years after he died, there were so many Jews who were caught up in a sense of religious militants that they actually did start a war against Rome, and that's what brought in the Roman retribution. So that kind of thing was very much in the air. What we call politics and religion were not separated at all, either for Jews or Romans.
Professor Elaine Pagels is with us. She's the author of the book Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the scholar Elaine Pagels is with us to talk about the Book of Revelation. For all its strangeness, the book has had a powerful influence on Christians and Christianity. Pagels has written a book about it, so she'll walk us through the strangeness, explain where it all came from, and how each Christian generation has found its own way to relate to John's vision. So I wanted to go through some of the details of the vision itself. John says that he was sort of allowed to see the throne of heaven. He saw the thunder and lightning and fire, and there's sapphires and glittering crystals and rainbows. And of course, he sees, among other things, these four angels standing at the four corners of the earth.
Yes.
And they're placing these seals on the foreheads of 144,000 men. What you notice beyond just that colorful imagery are the numbers, and they seem to relate to symbols. What is the significance of that, the symbols themselves, the numbers, I suppose?
Well, that's so interesting, and many people ask that. I don't think there's one simple answer to that.
Sure.
That's an interesting question. I mean, there are many numbers. For example, it'll say, well, this is going to happen in 3.5 years. This will happen in 7 years. That occurs also in the book of Daniel.
Yeah.
And, of course, 7 is a sacred number in Jewish tradition, as you see from the 7 candlestick menorah. Mm. Right? But also what it does is reassure us, the audience, that even though the events we're seeing play out on Earth, say earthquakes, fire, catastrophe, plagues, war, they look random. They look completely chaotic.
Yeah.
But they're all part of a divine plan. They only last exactly as long as God wants, and they're all measured. So it basically communicates the message, this has a meaning. A divine meaning. It's under God's control. Don't worry. It's not out of God's control. And also, it won't last that long. So these are reassuring.
Yeah.
Another scholar, David Barr, has pointed out that probably in the early Christian movement, followers of Jesus memorized John's prophecy because a lot of people didn't read. And they would go from church to church preaching it. And when you're preaching it, you've memorized it, it would be easier if you had 7 angels and 7 bowls and 7 plagues and 7 horses. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And that sort of makes it easier to memorize. So it can be also a storytelling device. But I think primarily it communicates the sense, even though you don't see it, God has a plan.
John sees a star fall from heaven. It's another of these angels he refers to, one who leads this army of angels and opens this bottomless pit. Who is this? Is this kind of a devil figure?
Well, that's Abaddon. Yes,
Abaddon,
he is called the angel from the abyss. That's one of his names. There are many strange figures in this. But you asked also about the numbers. And then when you get to the images of the beasts, John speaks about two beasts that are allies of the great dragon who symbolizes the forces of evil. And one of the beasts, he says, has a number. And, of course, you know the number. He says it's a human number. Let the one who understands understand. And that number, of course, is 666. But that number has a special meaning.
How do we understand it? I mean, there's some sense that he's referring to, and I wonder if people would have understood at the time, some great leader, some sense that it might have been Nero? Am I getting that right?
Yes. I mean, the way there were, in Jewish mystical thought, every letter would have a number equivalent, like alpha might be, you know, one, and beta might be two. I'm using the Greek alphabet, but they would use Hebrew, although John wrote in Greek. And so your name or any name could add up to a certain number, depending on whether you multiply or divide or add or, you know, how you work with those numbers. The system was called gematria, which means it's a kind of geometry. And so when he says the beast has a human number, John is referring to the forces of evil on earth. Its representative is a human being. And probably most people have tried to sort of struggle with the actual names and say the beasts represent the Roman Empire and, the of course, the emperors in particular. The beast with seven heads has seven heads. Mm-hmm. And the head of the empire is the emperor, of course. And Nero's name, if you take his whole formal imperial name, could add up to 666. So probably the beast is understood to be a human being, and that particular human being.
Yeah. The bright red dragon, as you said, with seven heads in front of her. The dragon is waiting for this baby. And I mean, there are dragons and monsters. And today we have this image of them, you know, as coming from kind of fantasy stories of dragons.
Yes.
How did the people of the time think of a dragon or a monster?
Well, that's a good question, because it does look like, you know, children's stories, dragons. And then there's this woman who's kind of the whore of Babylon, a sort of monstrous figure. These are actually traditional images when you trace them. If you look at the prophecies of Isaiah or Ezekiel or Daniel, when they're talking about Israel's enemies, and they mean the people who conquered us, they mean the Egyptians, they mean the Babylonians, and John, of course, means the Romans, they speak of them as kind of monstrous beasts, the leader of those empires, the pharaoh, the king, the emperor, is seen as a monster whom God is going to spear and kill like a fish. So this is a traditional image. And the horror of Babylon, as often pictured there, is an image that comes out of Isaiah. And it's a representative of the city of Babylon after the Babylonian Empire and the Babylonian armies had completely destroyed Israel. So John is using these traditional images to say, well, today's Babylon is Rome, and today's whore is the goddess Roma, who looks very much like this monstrous image that he pictures, and today's beast is Rome.
Was he using a lot of this imagery as a way of kind of disguising his propaganda? Was this a way to sort of cover himself if people found out, you know, protect himself from Roman authorities or Roman leaders?
It certainly could be, because, you know, to denounce the Roman Empire in these kind of extremely hostile terms could have put somebody in great danger, particularly a Jew who was known to do that. So it could be a disguised language, but any Jew who knew the prophecies would know exactly what he's talking about.
How did we come to the idea that it was written by John the Apostle, one of Jesus' original disciples? I mean, it seems like the idea was the result, in some way, at least as I understood it, of kind of the arguments about the book of Revelation, you know, whether it deserved to be included in the Bible itself.
This was always the most controversial book in the whole Bible.
Yeah.
And the arguments were about whether the prophecies were valid or whether they were crazy, whether they're written by some sort of madman who was a heretic, or whether they were written by a genuine apostle. Can you trust them, or are they just bizarre?
Right.
I mean, people have always split over this book. Some people love it. Some people hate it. Almost nobody is neutral. So the people who hated it said it was written by a heretic and a madman. This is right after it was written. And the people who loved it said, it's actually Jesus' disciple, John. Mm. So that was a way of making the book acceptable. So, well, if it's his disciple wrote it, and he also wrote the Gospel of John, which he probably didn't, but that's the tradition, then the book is brought into the right circle, you know, and you could trust it.
You write about how the book of Revelation barely squeezed into the canon to become the final book of the New Testament. And I wanted to talk about that. I mean, we have, I think you've said, five lists of books that were being considered for the Bible. And all of them leave the book of Revelation off except for one. Is that right?
Yes, that's right, except that actually there probably were lots more than five.
Sure.
This is after it was legal to be a Christian. After the times of persecution when the Emperor Constantine became a Christian, suddenly it was okay to be a Christian. Not only okay, you could get social advancement, you could get privileges. So many, many people joined the church. The bishops became important people, and they began to say, all right, well, we have to draw up a list of which are the right books for Christians to read. And I think probably many bishops and many councils did that. We have five of them that I mentioned done between the years 350 and 400. And four out of the five have most of the books that now are in the New Testament, like the Gospels, the letters of Paul, and so forth. Mm. Four of them leave the book of Revelation out.
Yeah.
And the historian who tells us most about it, Eusebius, who's a bishop himself, gives us two lists. And he says, well, these are the accepted books of the New Testament. And he goes to the Gospels and the letters. And then he says, and well, if you think it's right, maybe the book of Revelation, which there are disputes about. And then when he gives you the list of what he calls illegitimate books, he gives you all kinds of books that are nowhere in the New Testament. They're just gone. And at the end of the list of disputed books, he says, and, you know, maybe the book of Revelation.
Wow.
And so this is the only book he puts on both the right list and the wrong list.
Yeah.
And what he means by that is people argue about it. But the one list that we have with that book on it is the one that became the New Testament canon. So when I say it squeezed into the canon, it barely made it.
Yeah. And this was the list of the Bishop of Alexandria in Egypt. And he wanted to use the image of this cosmic war not to be about the Roman Empire, but to be the war against this new Catholic Church. So this image was helpful for him, I guess.
Yes, because at the time he was writing, and this is really an important point that you made, first of all, you know, John had said that the Roman Empire was going to be destroyed. Well, it didn't happen. I mean, something completely different happened. An emperor became a Christian and turned this, or tried to turn it, into a Christian empire. So you might say, well, I guess those prophecies are wrong.
Right.
And a lot of people did say that. But this bishop, in that new Christian world, said, well, no, you just have to reinterpret the prophecies. And then he was trying to make sure that his group of Christians, he called them Catholic Christians, universal Christians,
right,
would win out over all others. And his teaching about Christianity, which claimed that Christ is actually God, would win out against all others. Other people said, well, Christ isn't God. He's the Son of God, but he's not God. I mean, he never says he's God. That's so un-Jewish. But Athanasius's unlikely formulation was accepted at the Council of Nicaea. We call it the Nicene Creed. And with that, he wanted to establish the Catholic clergy and the Catholic church. And so he basically reinterpreted John's book and said, well, what it really means is that the people who go in Lake of Fire are not the Romans. They're the heretics. Mm. They're the people who disagree with us. They're the wrong kind of Christians, if you like. And the people who go into the heavenly Jerusalem are not just sort of God's Israel, but they're Orthodox Christians.
Yeah.
So this book took on a whole new meaning, and it's been used for almost 2,000 years in very different ways than John originally imagined.
So it's really malleable, I guess, the book of Revelation. It can bend to meet other people's interpretations. I mean, we see all kinds of images in art and literature My favorite, William Blake, I have to say, his images are really scary and kind of beautiful, too.
Yes, I mean, they are quite powerful images of the Book of Revelation. Blake saw it as a kind of spiritual struggle. Mm. He didn't see it as war. And he does picture it in a very remarkable way. They're some of my favorite pictures, too. But other people saw it as a book about war, whether it was World War II, whether it was the war in Iraq, whether it's any conflict you want to talk about, whether it was the American Civil War. People in the middle of war have often recognized that this is a book about strong conflict and right and wrong. And when they see war that way, they often read themselves into it. The way that it works so well is that these images, like a beast, a whore, a monster, a dragon, could be part of your nightmares or mine or anyone's, and therefore could represent any sort of terrible force that you see as threatening.
Yeah. Talk about how the founder of Mormonism, Joseph Smith, how did he conceive of the Book of Revelation? That seems to have informed his idea, I guess, of the end of times, of these apocalyptic visions, which I guess weren't uncommon for Christians.
That's really true. I mean, you see it actually in the year 1000, when many Christians thought that was going to be the end of time.
Yeah.
And many people, inspired by the Book of Revelation, many Christians in France took up weapons to take Jerusalem back from the Muslims and started the First Crusade. It's been taken up in every century, and people have often seen the end of time. The 19th century, many people thought, was really the coming of the end of time, the coming of terrible trials. The Civil War in this country, imagine, I mean, there's no conflict as horrible as that in this country. And so people on both sides of the Civil War saw it as the end of time. The Battle Hymn of the Republic was a Union war song. You know, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He's trampling out the vintage." They saw the Union armies as bringing God's wrath on this country for the sin of slavery, and Confederate singers saw their side as trying to destroy the evil beast, which they saw as to be the Union, and Lincoln as its representative. So Joseph Smith wasn't alone. We have so many groups: Seventh-day Adventists, Jehovah's Witnesses, the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints is named that because followers of Joseph Smith believed that they were in the latter days, the final days, and that Jesus would soon return.
Of course, there were those who didn't like it. Martin Luther wasn't a fan. Thomas Jefferson, he excised it out of the New Testament.
That's right.
What's the difference between those who did have an affection for it and who took to it and those who didn't? Is it the way they interpret the New Testament, the way they see
Christianity? I think so, yes. I think it's the way they interpret the message of Jesus. Yeah. I mean, Luther said, this book should not be in there because there's no Christ in it. It's not about compassion and love. It's about vengeance and judgment and an angry God and destroying people. Then later, Martin Luther realized that he could use it against the Catholic Church when he came into sharp conflict with it. And in the first Luther Bible, he had his friend Lucas Cranach draw woodcuts of the Whore of Babylon as the Pope of Rome.
Wow.
So in the Luther Bible, when you were reading the Book of Revelation, you would see a picture of the Catholic Pope dressed as the Whore of Babylon. So you would know what this is about, you see. And Luther's enemies did the same thing. I mean, his Catholic opponents pictured him as the great seven-headed beast.
Wow.
So that's the way these images have proved so durable and also so adaptable, because you could apply them to so many situations. As you know, people still do it.
Elaine Pagels is with us, the author of the book Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. We need to take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Professor Elaine Pagels. We're talking about her book, Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. She's joining us from the studios on the Princeton campus in Princeton, New Jersey. So I want to talk about divine judgment. Of course, God invites the vultures to come and feast on the flesh of the vanquished in this vision, and Satan is thrown into this pit, and the faithful sort of come back to life, and Jesus then judges the world. And those who, you know, worshipped other gods or committed murder, who had illicit sex, they're thrown down to be tormented forever in this lake of fire. And Christ and his people then will triumph and reign for 1,000 years. That's the idea. But I wanted to ask you about how John saw divine judgment, because you write about this in the book, how the movement of Christianity came to kind of divide those who would be saved and those who would be damned. And you say John's vision, yes, for judgment offered a kind of wide range of interpretations. And in some ways, it could have been seen as different from Jesus Christ. Is that right?
Well, it could, you know, because I think that's why Martin Luther said there's no Christ in it. I mean, he felt that this idea of eternal judgment, people being tortured forever, was not the message of a loving God. But interestingly, it did get placed in that book and has become hugely influential.
So I guess the question is why? You know, what effect it's had? Because you say Christianity developed, you know, these institutional structures, and people, yes, came to be judged or seen anyway, not so much on how they act, but whether they went along with the, you know, the policies and the doctrines. So is it too simplistic then to say that the Book of Revelation hasn't been so good for Christians or Christianity? Does that make sense?
It depends what you think is good for Christianity.
Of course.
I mean, there were people who said, you know, outside the church, there's no salvation. So what that does, if you believe that, say, if you're not a Christian, if you're, say, a Jew, if you're an agnostic, if you're a heretic, if you're a Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, well, you're just out. And there's no hope for you. And, of course, there are Christians who say that.
Yeah.
Then this book is for you.
Right.
Because basically it says, you know, there are the saved, and, of course, we are. But they, whoever we think they are completely going to hell. Mm. Now, today, as you may know, I mean, among many serious Christians and among evangelical Christians as well, there's a lot of debate about whether a loving God would sentence most of the human race to eternal torture.
Right.
And there are people who say, this doesn't make sense. We don't accept that. So we could reinterpret it, or we could say, hey, we just don't agree with that. But that is, of course, how most of Christianity has survived for a couple thousand years, that if you're not a Christian, there's no hope for you. Mm. And so many evangelical Christians and others will say to this day, well, yes, you have to be saved through Jesus, and only Jews who become Christians at the end will be saved. Of course, that wasn't quite the way John of Patmos saw it.
Right.
But that's one way that his book has been read. And it's powerfully affirmed, say, the absolute uniqueness and necessity of becoming a Christian.
In some ways, you return to the secret writings that you've spent a good part of your career studying, other writings that didn't make it into the canon. And you say, especially now, in the book, you say, in an increasingly connected world,
yes,
these are other visions from lost and silenced voices that give our sense of revealed truth, I guess, more complexity. I mean, you talk about what we need is a more universal vision maybe than what John of Patmos was offering. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's what's so interesting to me and what I discovered is that this isn't the only way to construe the Christian faith, right? Mm-hmm. That even in the early movement, there were many who saw God as a loving being who had created the human race in all of its diversity and complexity, and actually loved that diversity and complexity of the human race, that wasn't a horrible mistake that people speak different languages and have different cultures and different religious traditions, that in fact all of these offer paths toward God, right?
Yeah.
And there are people of every faith, whether they're Hindu or Christian or Jewish or agnostic, who see it that way. But in the early Christian movement, there were lots of people who saw it that way. And they thought revelation wasn't just something given to a single prophet and sort of dictated from on high, but spiritual insight or revelation was something that you could seek, you could look for. You could do it with prayer, meditation. You could do it with spiritual discipline and trying to open yourself to receiving what the divine might show to you. So these other texts fascinated me because they really show a very wide range of openness to spiritual discipline. You know, some people say today, well, you know, there's all of these Buddhists and these people studying foreign religions. Well, there were those in antiquity too. And so now we begin to see that there are many people talking about revelation, not as sort of the divine judgment and the end of the world, but as how the divine is revealed, how it's revealed sometimes through a silent voice that speaks internally to a person, that reveals spiritual truth. And I think that those visions, which also speak about human beings as a whole, might be a model we need in a world where maybe we can't afford with nuclear weapons to say whoever we're against must be evil and we have to try to annihilate them. Or, of course, they want to annihilate us. There are people in other faiths, of course, who have adopted the same view. I mean, you see this in some Muslim circles as you see it in some Christian circles, you know, that Christians are the infidels, the enemy, and so forth, or Jews are the infidels and the enemy. That way of thinking has, of course, fostered religious commitment in war. And that may be an old habit that we either can't afford or want to reconsider or maybe even give up and try to understand how if there's two sides, it's not necessarily good against evil, but us against them, and we need to negotiate with them. They need to negotiate with us so that nobody gets annihilated in the process.
There's probably no point to the hypothetical, but I do wonder if the church fathers had left Revelation out of the Bible, do you ever wonder how it would have changed the way Christianity developed and evolved? How would it have, you know, become less dogmatic, less doctrinaire in some ways?
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't know if it would have become less dogmatic, but it might not have had a sanction for war, now that you mention it, because this book has always been used as a sanction for war, whatever side you're on. In the wars against Napoleon, wars between Catholics and Protestants in England from 1600, 1700, 1800, religious wars of all kinds, Christians against Muslims. This book, I mean, I'm just asking myself, I've never thought of it quite the way you put it, but it's a very good question to ask. Would there be a religious sanction for war in the New Testament without this book?
Let me ask you this finally. So if this is a test then about, or one of the tests anyway, the book of Revelation about how Christianity has persisted and why people think certain ways about religion, you have two elements here, of course. There's the idea of fear, which the book of Revelation appeals to. But you also point out very importantly that the book does also appeal to the idea of hope. You know, it ends in this glorious new world. But I wonder if you've learned anything about the inclinations of humankind. Are we more inclined to hope or fear?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. I think both are really deeply possible. Fear is a very powerful motivator. You know, when I was writing this book, I was asking that question we started with, why is it that religion hasn't died out, you know?
Yeah.
When people get more scientifically educated, why do we still have these same kinds of powerful religious traditions that motivate people? And I began to think that this book is an interesting test case because it's so popular, so widely read. Because what it suggests is that religious traditions are not a question of mental concepts like, do you believe in God? Do you believe in Jesus? That's almost more abstract. You see what I mean?
Sure.
But they're more about how people feel viscerally. Do you have hope for the human race? Do you think we're all doomed? I think I was reading the work of neurologists like Antonio Damasio at the University of Southern California, who wrote a book called Descartes' Error. Mm. And he thinks the error that the philosopher Descartes made was to think reason is more important than it is in the way we make decisions as human beings. And he suggests that we have to understand that much of what we think are rational decisions are driven by emotions, far more than we think. And if we recognize that, we can recognize that our religious traditions, too, both draw on and encourage our emotional states. I mean, I would hope they would move us toward hope.
Elaine Pagels, her latest book is called Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. Professor, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.